And you open the door and you step inside. We're inside our hearts. Now imagine your pain is a white ball of healing light.
Welcome to Fight Club Club. The first rule of Fight Club Club is you talk about Fight Club. The podcasts are bare knuckle. No shirt, no shoes, no weapons. If this is your first time at Fight Club Club, you have to podcast. I'm joined today by foot soldiers of Project Mayhem, Jason from the New York on Earth Substack, and Daniel, our mysterious anarcho-punk film critic. How's it going today, space monkeys?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much, Mr. Durden, sir.
Yeah, shirtless and shoeless.
Yep, we're not wearing shirts. We're not going to post the video to confirm that, but you'll just have to imagine that that's the case. We are in a basement. Jason and I are in the same basement. Daniel's in a different basement. And we are ready to not fight. We are going to, well, maybe we will fight a little bit, but we're not going to fight like they do in Fight Club. We're going to talk about the movie and the book Fight Club. It's the 25th anniversary of the film coming out. And I will make my argument that it's a incredibly important film politically, and we'll just sort of go through it. And then in the second episode, we'll talk about Joker 2. So let me get started by asking you two your history with Fight Club. Like, when did you see the movie? What was the impact of it on you when you first saw it? And let's start with Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it on home video, probably right as the home video came out. We likely got it from Blockbuster. My friend definitely had it as a VHS tape, and we would watch it every single time I slept over at his house, which was basically every weekend.
Okay, Unc.
Yeah, and between NoFX breaking up and watching Fight Club last night at 3 in the morning, I really, really brought back some uncomfortable teenage feelings, for sure. Yeah, it was my favorite movie. Full stop.
Yeah, me too. What about you, Jason?
I'm trying to remember the exact context I saw Fight Club. I, probably around 20 years ago, also on VHS. Yeah, I saw it probably around the time I was getting into movies. A bunch of my friends worked at an independent video store where, not Blockbuster, but one of the indies where the longer you hang out there, the more you realize that it's being subsidized by porn rentals. But, occasionally there's decent independent film, like one of those, iconic classic bygone VHS rental stores.
Was there a beaded, curtain?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, beaded curtain, the 80s VHS covers on the side of the beaded curtain. But once you got into the fully encased room, it was,
Yeah.
All bodies and all.
Behind the green door.
We got to have the curtain.
Oh, yeah. Beaded curtain, everything.
But yeah, what did you think of the movie when you first saw it?
I think I loved it. I mean, I'm trying to remember exactly what I felt about it, because like I said, I saw it at the time I was started watching movies all the time as a teenager. But I do remember what impact it had on me. One, me and some friends very briefly started a one-off fight club, fighting not in a basement, in the middle of a field that there was not a second attempt at. But I think probably more relevant to this conversation, it got me into some of Chuck Palahniuk's early work. I didn't end up reading Fight Club after seeing the movie, but I read Survivor and Choke, and his memoir about Travelogue of Portland, the 2003 Fugitives and Refugees. And even back then, Chuck Palahniuk was very big on teaching his style of writing. He was very, and there's three things that I remember from being into. All these are elements that play out not only in Fight Club, the novel, but how the movie itself and, subsequent works, bare minimalist prose. He was very big on praising an author named Amy Hempel, who was very minimalist with her prose. A lot of info dumps of subversive topics, sort of as a distraction, but also interlacing that with the notion of a chorus that you should repeat lines, I am Jack's rage and that sort of thing. So those are the three motifs that he taught, and that's kind of remembering that's how I look at his work now when I've seen it, and rewatching this film and also listening to the audiobook not too long ago, it was very clear that Fight Club was exhibit A of everything that he was teaching, so to speak.
Yeah, I saw it. I I probably did also just see it on video when it first came out in early 2000, I guess. But the reason why I'm like really been on this Fight Club kick recently is because I've been thinking a lot about the 90s and like the sort of Gen X politics and it transitioning towards the political moment when me and Daniel, and I assume also you, sort of became politicized or like got our education in revolutionary politics. And I was really fascinated by this thing in the 90s where there was a trope of movies that was these Gen X movies where there was these dual protagonists who was a yuppie and a slacker. And like I think the best example, there's a lot of examples, but the best example is probably Reality Bites.
Yeah.
Where you have Ben Stiller, who's this yuppie, and he's trying to win Janine Garofalo's affection against Ethan Hawke, who's like, you know, just hanging out in his house, playing video games and like a sarong. What?
It's Winona Ryder. Garofalo is the pissed off roommate who works at the Gap.
Okay. Should have been Janine Garofalo, but working at the Gap and they're like struggling to, you know, like they're like recognize their jobs are meaningless. And then there's this kind of bedroom stoner philosopher guy who's like shaming everybody for having a job. But and I think that was sort of like the political moment in the 90s for the sort of like downwardly mobile or like, you know, lower rung of the middle class youth. It's like, well, we have this opportunity to be an office drone, but, you know, we also are like against corporate culture. We're against like big capitalism. We have these problems, but the problems aren't like really super fleshed out as to what we want to see change. So you have this political culture in the 90s that's like no logo, you know, really against like Nike, people starting to wear brands on their t-shirt, vaguely against the banks. And, you know, you get the rise of like a very popular environmentalist movement. You know, you have this mass boycott of like tuna for killing dolphins and that sort of thing. You know, these were sort of the mainstream politics of the time for it. Like saving the rainforest was a big thing. But none of these politics assertive in any way. There weren't big protest movements. There certainly wasn't militant street activity until December 99, when there's like the first major North American black bloc in Seattle against the WTO. And that begins this cycle of street militarism, which arguably has continued to this day, but begins with the anti-globalization movement. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Fight Club comes out a month before the WTO.
God damn it, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables, slaves with white collars. Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need. We're the middle children of history, man. No purpose or place. We have no great war. No great depression. Our great war is a spiritual war. Our great depression is our lives.
In Fight Club, you get the first example of the yuppie versus slacker dynamic, but the slacker is like a revolutionary who is organizing a revolutionary group that is going to literally destroy financial towers and like, before that, like blows up the Starbucks and does all these culture jammings and like attacks the elites and stuff. So that's why I was so fascinated with Fight Club as a sort of political conjuncture, or like capturing the spirit of the tides turning between the younger Gen X, the younger Gen X and the millennials coming up. Matrix also came out the same time, which had a similar effect. But I think Fight Club, maybe for like young men like us at the time, had such a strong effect. You know, I remember when I saw the movie, I was in high school, so I wasn't like an office worker, but the alienation and boredom and the desire to live a bohemian revolutionary life that escapes the sort of trajectory that you're expected to be on as a young white suburban was super effective. Like the line, "This is your life and you're dying 1 minute at a time," is it really hit me like a taser. And so let's start with Jason's background on Chuck Palahniuk and like his own sort of politicization.
Yeah, it is a very unlikely story. I want to interject real quick just to paint a portrait of the cultural moment of, you know, politics in popular culture. There also was a Beastie Boys tour where the opening acts were Rage Against the Machine and Atari Teenage Riot.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, Rage is a part of this too, for sure.
So, yeah, like I mentioned earlier, one of the Chuck Palahniuk books I read after seeing Fight Club when I was very, like, oh, wanted to read all his early stuff was Fugitives and Refugees. And it's a half travelogue of Portland where he's even, as I recall, even imagining at the time, you know, like half these, you know, these bathhouses, these crazy, quirky individuals and their independent museums, these are all going to disappear. And, you know, like a raw version of Portland than what Portlandia portrayed, which arguably is Fred Armisen's Wicker Park, Chicago, early 90s nostalgia, but that's a different rant. But so one of the things he mentions is like becoming very involved in SantaCon and very involved with this group called Cacophony Society. And so when thinking about, okay, how did Fight Club exist, or like, why did he write this book? You know, it's like, okay, where did Cacophony Society come from? And it came from, you can trace it all the way back to the 1878 Robert Louis Stevenson novel called Suicide Club. You know, Stevenson being better known for Treasure Island or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But Suicide Club is essentially this three short stories about a prince from Bohemia who comes across this club of rich men in a secret society called Suicide Club, where they're unsatisfied with their lives, but they can't go through with killing themselves. So the premise of the club is randomly these men get together and randomly someone is chosen to be killed and someone is chosen to do the killing and essentially stage the suicide. And so this becomes relevant a century later in San Francisco. A group of people form a pseudo secret society called Suicide Club. And what the, you know, they do urban exploration, street theater and pranks. They do stuff like infiltrating the American Nazi Party or the Reunification Church. And their whole shtick is like living life to the fullest. Like a few people involved in the group are influenced by DeBoer and the Situationists, the Society of the Spectacle. Bear in mind that this is taking place, you know, roughly a decade after the Situationists had, you know, influenced the student movement in Paris. And so there's like a bunch of offshoots, like Suicide Club has like maybe a 5-year run. And then there are a few offshoots, one of them being Cacophony Society, one of them starting under Suicide Club, but continuing, I think, to this day, is the Billboard Liberation Front, which is essentially, you know, remixing and culture jamming billboards to humorous or political effects. But also Burning Man is an offshoot of Cacophony Society. SantaCon is an offshoot of Cacophony Society.
All the things we love today, Burning Man and SantaCon.
Burning Man.
For what it's worth, SantaCon, my first exposure to SantaCon was I was at the Punk Rock Olympics at CBGB's, and because I was like probably 15, I was having trouble getting in, and SantaCon was going on, and this was like, must have been like 2002, 2001. So this was not something that was like... Yeah, this was not like every asshole finance frat bro person. This was only weird degenerates. And outside of that show, I met several people who are still involved in the punk scene today who became good friends. And we also were just marching around with the Santas because we had nothing else to do. And it was actually a very good time. And it was extremely disruptive and extremely fucking stupid in a way that was not the way it's extremely fucking stupid now, where you're just like, oh God, these horrible misogynist dickheads are throwing up on me and knocking me over. It's pretty great. I get it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, SantaCon sort of did. There was a time when SantaCon was like sort of beloved culturally as we still have some things like that in New York now, like the big pillow fight that they do, Bike Kill, you know, like the idiot Arad, where it's like a race across the city. Yeah, and shopping carts. Like, there's still these DIY cultural festivals that people like now, but SantaCon became such a bro thing that I think people now really, really hate it.
Yeah, I mean, SantaCon, Burning Man, I mean, these all came out of, you know, Cacophony and Suicide Club as, you know, this incubator and gathering all these people of, you know, self-actualization for, like, subversive fun group pranks, essentially. And even, like, early 90s Burning Man, you know, you had Cacophony members, anarchists, ravers, early tech scene people, you know, early Google folks. So, I mean, you know, obviously the seeds are planted for, you know, Burning Man and SantaCon to, you know, become what they are. But, you know, obviously this, you know, this is, you know, this is the cultural petri dish, so to speak, that Cacophony is breeding. And so, you know, they have chapters across, you know, the country, including Portland. And there is an oral history called Tales from the Cacophony Society. And Chuck Palahniuk actually writes a foreword for it. And he says that the first time that he came across it, he saw a flyer for like a voodoo wedding at some tiki bar. And, you know, he just saw a bunch of uninhibited dorks dancing around to kitschy music. And just as the bar was filling up with too many people, they started like somebody dressed as a voodoo doctor just tossed stuff into the air. And it turned out to be like giblets and guts. And like most of the people were screaming and cleared out. And he's like, that was his entry level into the Cacophony Society. And, you know, became, you know, participated in SantaCon, participated in all manner of things. To the point where he says, like, when he primarily describes Fight Club, you know, it's a mix of different experiences of his, but one of them is the pranks and hijinks that he got into in the Cacophony Society, which is interesting to consider because Cacophony, you know, it seems like relative, you know, benign, you know, compared to, like, what's depicted in Fight Club, or just particularly the philosophy of Tyler Durden. And one more thing to point out, I think that is like interesting given like the influence of Fight Club, is that Fight Club was not Chuck's first novel. He wrote Invisible Monsters first, which, you know, has like trans and drag characters in a sympathetic light. And so when that was rejected by publishers, Fight Club was allegedly written as sort of like a fuck you, let me double down and make an even less publishable book.
Hey folks, Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall.